Welcome, everyone. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. We are glad you are here with us at the end of the year 2013, as we are getting ready to head into 2014, our 8th year doing this radio program with a website that has been going for over 13 years now. That is indeed something. We have been, I would say, uncompromising in our search to find answers on our terms and find information in our way about all the things that we are interested in. You know, all the topics. We have yet so much more to cover, and we'll keep asking questions and continue to dig for those answers. We do not, of course, believe in all the things that we cover. We, in fact, question everything that we hear, as this is the very essence of the program. The philosophy, if you will, is that we investigate. You could call it an ongoing open source investigation. And the upside is that you as a listener can tune in and judge the material, the answers, the information, and even the person, if you so will, yourself. If you use your own discernment and not someone else's, there is always something to learn. We hope that even the most hardcore skeptic also, in fact, can learn something from listening to our program. So that would be our short nutshell version, if you will, if you're a newcomer and if you're very, very confused about what this program is about. But of course, you can find more at redicecreations.com. So don't take my word for it. You can actually investigate this for yourself, as the proof of what we do is right there on the website. Okay, today we are going to talk about the legacy of Mr. Lloyd Pye, a friend to this program, a great presenter and researcher on the intervention theory and what was later named the Star Child Skull, who very, very unfortunately passed away earlier this month. We have with us to do this Amy Vickers. She was an archaeology student in Australia when she first learned about the unusual 900-year-old skull. In 2004, she joined the Star Child Project, the team investigating the skull and coordinating independent research into this unusual specimen. She has helped to develop websites and videos for the project, worked to coordinate research on the skull, and is now the CEO of the project. Amy will also discuss the latest updates with the Star Child skull, as she is now leading the charge. Amy, hey, thanks for coming on. Hope you're doing well today. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Now, it's of course under sad circumstances that we do meet, because our both acquaintance and friend, and in your case an ex-husband, actually has passed away, Lloyd Pye. It's very, very sad when I heard about the news, but his sickness came out of the blue, obviously, to himself as well, it seems like. And well, for those who don't know, maybe you can just tell us a little bit what actually happened to Lloyd and what kind of, you know, sickness he got to before we talk a little bit more about his work, Amy.
Well, Lloyd Pye was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of lymphoma only about 6 months ago, really. It was sort of the middle of this year, and immediately went through straight away into alternative treatments, taking all of the supplements you can imagine. He very diligently researched everything that was available and knew from very early in that he didn't really want to go down the chemotherapy road whatsoever. So he got himself into an alternative and a holistic clinic in Europe that actually also did a small amount of low-dose chemotherapy. So he was doing chemotherapy, he was doing the alternative treatments, he was on everything that you can think of, doing the best that he could, but unfortunately the cancer was just so aggressive that every time they knocked it back, it just came back very quickly, twice as strong as it was before, and he went downhill very, very rapidly just in the last month or thereabouts. It went from, oh, it's regrowing again, to him very sadly passing away on December the 9th, which has been a terrible shock to all of us.
Yeah, indeed. It's very, very sad. And of course, Lloyd was an articulate and funny and, you know, very, very good researcher when it comes to not only the Star Child project and the Star Child skull that we're going to talk a little bit more with you about today, who's kind of picked up a little bit here. Well, you work with Lloyd for some time now, but also just the idea that he was into offering a third option, I guess we should call it, between, you know, Darwinism and evolution and the you know, greater God kind of scenario, and it just, I don't know, just his research was so very well encompassing and everything. So we've lost a great person, Amy.
Yes, Lloyd was a great man, and he had that amazing ability to look at the same set of facts that everybody else was baffled by and connect the dots and find a solution that was plausible, that made scientific sense. He always tried to look at the facts like a mathematical equation, that there had to be a 1+1=2 scenario. And by working through all of these things that people consider to be quite out there in a very scientific and a very methodical manner, he was able to come up with the intervention theory of origins, where he was able to pinpoint quite specifically moments in the timeline of life on Earth where there appears to have been very deliberate intervention, bringing new life forms, for example, during the Cambrian explosion, where one minute you've got basically algae and the next minute you've got every genus of species that is currently on Earth. So he was able to look at this information and bring it together and bring it to a logical conclusion and then stand up and make that conclusion publicly against the ridicule and against the criticism that he faced for it. He really had an incredible amount of courage to push that research forward in the face of that adversity. But I know that he has left some books partially finished, so his research certainly has not ended just because we sadly have to continue without him.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the introduction of anaerobic bacteria alone, I mean, that should be headline news around the world, you know? It's like, it's unbelievable that so many things that he did talk about haven't been, you know, more known. But, you know, as you said, hopefully the work will continue, and I guess some of that his work on the hominids as well is a very important factor. And I guess, unfortunately, that's where a lot of people also kind of fall out. They just, you know, they put the Bigfoot stamp on it and then, oh, that's it. And they leave it. But the way Lloyd kind of composed that and pulled together that material, it makes complete sense. You know, okay, it might not be the whole picture, the complete truth and all that, but nonetheless, it's a very, very important factor and point in our, you know, evolutionary path to how we ended up here, basically.
Well, you're absolutely right. And this goes back to the point about looking at the facts and coming up with the logical conclusion. It's so simple when you actually sit back and think about it. We're all taught that evolution follows a logical progression and everything dies out after a certain period of time and it grows into a newer, better species. But we've still got the same algae that's been here for millions of years. We've still got living dinosaurs like crocodiles, like the coelacanths. There are so many examples of things that have not died out. Lloyd's argument was very simply, well, if all of these other things are still alive in pockets around the world, isn't it possible that the pre-humans, the things like Neanderthals, are still alive in pockets of very dense, unexplored jungles in places around the world? And his theory was basically that these beings, hominids, Bigfoot, the skunk ape, the Yowie in Australia, all of these things that come under that hominid / Bigfoot headline are all just non-extincted, what we would call pre-humans. And when you hear it put that way, it sounds really logical, but when you put on a lab coat and try and make fun of it, then it's very easy to get people to throw logic out the window because we're all so afraid of being made to look silly by someone that we respect. And Lloyd just somehow didn't have that fear. He would just shrug it off and say, I don't care what you think. This is what the evidence says, and that's the direction that I'm going to continue pursuing. And he never once found anything that threw his theory out the window. And in fact, as genetic science has come along, increasingly all of the predictions that he's made along the way have been proven to be correct. Whereas you've got people now like Richard Dawkins coming out and saying, well, actually, no, we probably are never going to find the missing link and it's not that simple. And they have to backtrack and come up with all of this waffling talk to try and make sense of these theories that simply can't be proven. And so instead of trying to say, well, or maybe we're wrong because the theory can't be proven, they're trying to make up Band-Aid solutions for it, whereas Lloyd's theory doesn't need those Band-Aid solutions. It's just been right and nothing's ever been put out there that can stand in its way.
Yeah, I mean, you guys are continuing some of this work now, and there are certainly many capable people out there that are talking about this kind of work, but his Lloyd's shoes will not be that easy to fill, I think. Well, what do you think, Amy?
I couldn't agree more. Lloyd always talked about in his wildest dreams, if he could do it one day, putting together sort of a scholarship program where people like him would have the resources that mainstream scientists have access to, sort of a grant system for alternative researchers. He always knew that one person couldn't change this enormous system of bad information, that it was going to take hundreds if not thousands of people. And that's what he's worked towards. That's what he's always hoped for, that there are going to be people who read his books and watch his videos that are so inspired that they start taking on research for themselves. And I know he was working with a number of people like that before he passed away. So there are a lot of people that are going to take up that torch for him. And there's a lot of people in the Star Child Project, which is the organization that I work for, who are going to have to sort of somehow combine together and find a way to fill those enormous shoes one little piece at a time.
Definitely. Now, let's see here. I just want to mention a bit as well. There are a couple of titles out there, both on the Star Child Skull, but then also, you know, The Intervention Theory, his book, and then Everything You Know Is Wrong. That's an excellent book as well, pulling all that together. And do you know about his website and such? Are there people, are you going to?
Absolutely. Lloyd's website is, of course, lloydpye.com, spelled L-L-O-Y-D-P-Y-E. And his print book is Everything You Know Is Wrong. But he actually has at least one ebook available on his website, Intervention Theory Essentials, that basically breaks down some of the more complicated ideas in his book into a much more easily digestible package with very clearly illustrated pictures. Of course, there are thousands of videos of Lloyd out there. He's also written books about the Star Child Skull, which is we'll be talking about in a minute. So there is Star Child Skull Essentials, which is the same sort of easily digestible packet. And there's also a print version called The Star Child Skull that is available through Amazon or from, I think, also through Lloyd's website. And, of course, we have our website, starchildproject.com. So there's a lot of information available to people, both in a book or available for free on the websites and through YouTube for anybody that's interested.
Now, I wanted to ask as well, do you know if there's someone who will continue the work, if you will, on the website and someone, do you guys have, what should I call, access to that? I know that in some cases when people pass away, sadly the website just kind of locks and sits there until even maybe, you know, website payments can't be made and then that's it. But do you know if there's an administrator for the website?
I'm afraid that all of that is completely out of our hands and is with the family at the moment. But until recently, I had actually been managing Lloyd's website for him. So I'm certainly going to do everything that I can to make sure that that continues because there's so much wonderful information there. And I'm perhaps not supposed to mention this, but he had another website just on hominoids that we had finished but that we hadn't launched yet. So hopefully that will be able to come out also. He has just such an enormous amount of information almost ready or almost finished, and I really do hope that that's able to be brought to fruition because it would be such a shame to let any scrap of knowledge from that great mind go to waste and not be made publicly available.
Very good. Now, so tell us a little bit of the tie-in, I guess, between you and Lloyd, how you came to work together, Amy.
Well, Lloyd Pye was introduced to the Star Child Skull, which is a very unusual human-like 900-year-old skull, by its then owners, Ray and Melanie Young. They were people who, Melanie was a neonatal nurse, Ray was a member of MUFON. They knew they had a skull that was not human, that was not a traditional deformity, and they thought from very early on that there could potentially be some sort of alien or some sort of alternative connection between that skull. So they wanted somebody that would be able to help them with the research but be open-minded enough that if it did start looking like there was an alien connection, that that person would follow it down that path to its proper conclusion. And a lot of Lloyd's work with hominids revolved around the shapes of the skulls as well as footprints and other things. But because of that reputation he had for knowing quite a lot about skulls and having various connections within the medical and the academic community to do with skulls, they sought him out back in 1999, and he agreed to come on board as the director and basically start the Star Child Project then and there. And then over the years, Lloyd was the one primarily that would go out and speak about the skull, that arranged the different independent labs and experts who investigated the skull right up to the DNA testing that's being done now. Loy was really the core figure within the Star Child project that kept it going all of those years. And so between 1999 and 2004, he was really doing most of the work on his own. And then in 2004, he lectured at the university I was attending in Australia. I was studying archaeology and law and a few other things. And I was just so taken with this interesting skull, and I couldn't understand why it wasn't being jumped on by my university, by every other university. It just seemed like such a fascinating thing. And my first thought wasn't necessarily alien, but just that this is clearly a new species. Surely people would want to jump on a new species. Everybody loves a new species, and yet yeah. somehow it just never managed to cross those hurdles. And so I came on board the project then and there. I just dropped my studies, moved over to the States with Lloyd, and we did eventually get married. But I came on board initially just, I sat him down and I said, it's clear to me that you need help and I'm prepared to help you. And that was that.
Very good. Now, I wanted to ask you there if there's maybe one of the reasons. I don't think this is the case, though, because other finds have also been very, you know, just the one sample, very rare things that's found, and then this whole kind of conclusion or whole theories and speculations revolve around them. But could there be potentially that it's only, well, there are other skulls too, but let's stick to what I guess people in the mainstream, if they ever even have heard about this, what they would know, they would be that, all right, it's just a one-off, it's got to be, you know, a genetic deformity or something like that, and therefore, you know, it's not really that interesting. Could that be one of the explanations why it hasn't been taken further and wider, if you will?
Well, that's a very common thing to think, and that, in fact, is what Lloyd Pye said the first time he saw it. This is probably some sort of deformity, but let's investigate it just to make sure. And that is usually the explanation that's given by anybody that hasn't really looked at the skull, but anybody that actually studies it and takes the time to read any of the research that's been done on it can see very quickly that it isn't any sort of standard deformity. And I think the DNA testing that we're doing now is going to put the nail in the coffin on that. But more than anything, I think it's because this was not found on an archaeological dig. It was not immediately handed over to a large institution. It was found by a teenage girl on holiday who brought it home as a souvenir and kept it on her mantelpiece or wherever for 60-odd years, and then it was passed on to somebody else and somebody else, and eventually wound up with Melanie Young, who was the first person that said, we should actually do some scientific investigation here. And because it's been in the private sector, and because we haven't just handed it over and risked it being shoved away in a basement and ignored somewhere, that has alienated us, I think, from a large section of the scientific and academic community. And then you get people like Lloyd, who already are in a bit of a touchy area with those people, because Lloyd was always very vocal about the lack of support and the lack right. of help that he received. So we did shoot ourselves in the foot on some occasions, like naming it the Star Child skull instead of, you know, skull FZ47 or whatever they would have preferred. We just did everything the wrong way. But as Lloyd used to say, it doesn't matter if we're walking down the street one day and this falls out of the sky. It doesn't matter that it doesn't have the sort of provenance and history that they want it to. It is real. It's not faked. It's not plastic. It's genuine bone. It's passed every test out there. The fact that it is there and that it exists should be enough to make a true scientist want to investigate it. And that the sad truth is there just aren't that many of those kind of scientists left. We're very fortunate to be working with a lot of them. But it's hard to find people like that who are willing to explore something really unusual and in some circles something quite unpopular as well, to risk their reputation and to risk the sort of handshake grant system that is out there that gives them access to their funding for the sake of doing pure science. So we're very lucky to have bumped into enough of those people to keep the research going.
Now, in a while, we'll talk more about the DNA testing, what's happening now, and that's, of course, been going for quite some while as well. But what is the possibility, then, that this is, considering the naming, because that's an interesting point you brought up there, what is the possibility that this is a so-called star child, Amy?
Well, a star child or a star being is traditionally thought of as the product of alien and human hybridization, where a woman is made pregnant with an alien child and you end up with a star being as the result of it. the DNA that we have from this skull so far is so different from human that interbreeding or hybridization probably wouldn't be possible. So at this stage, we're looking at something that preliminarily we think is just a pure alien, but the DNA is so different that that is a genuine possibility. There's a giant database of all of the DNA that's been recovered by using public funds in America at the NIH. And we basically ran the DNA results that we have through this enormous database looking for anything that was even just a similar match. And about half of the DNA that we've recovered came back out of that database saying that there is no significant similarity found. Now, some of it did match human, which is what you'd expect. We all share some percentage of our DNA with just about everything on the planet. But there was so much of this DNA that came back not found in anything that's ever been tested yet on planet Earth that it really is a legitimate possibility that we're looking at something that is alien in every sense of the word.
Very interesting. Now, how many I don't know what to call it, passes have the skull run through in terms of the tests of DNA, because I know we've, you know, done on off again kind of shows with Lloyd, updates continuously about what happened with the DNA, latest testings and everything else. How much of that has actually been done at this stage, and is there still more, to be revealed, if you will, with the DNA testing?
There's a lot more to be revealed. We have done DNA tests in the past. Basically, the DNA technology has come along in leaps and bounds over the last few years. The results that we're getting now were simply not possible in 2003 when we did our last round of DNA testing. We've had to wait for the technology to become advanced enough to be able to recover DNA of ancient bone that is so different from human. Basically, we're using the same technology that they developed to recover the Neanderthal DNA. So there are two things working against us. One, that it's ancient DNA, which makes it hard to recover in the first place. And two, it's so different than anything that's been seen before that the usual techniques where you're looking for something that you know what it is, called the primer system, that just simply doesn't work with the Starchild skull. That's why we've had partial and incomplete results at every other step along the way. So this is the first time that we're able to recover the entire genome. That's the whole genetic blueprint for this being. And right now we've got less than 1% of that completed. There's two parts to DNA testing. One is actually getting the DNA out, and two is sequencing it and decoding it and making sense of it so you can actually see it and understand what you have. So we have at the moment a large amount of raw DNA data, but we're stuck because we need some more funding before we can actually decode that and find out what we have. It probably won't be the entire genome. It won't be the whole blueprint, but it will be quite a good chunk of it. It'll be enough for us to know properly whether this is a new species, whether it's completely unlike any DNA that's been seen on Earth before. It's as close as we're going to get to the sort of holy grail of the Starchild skull. So we are doing a fundraising campaign at the moment on starchildproject.com where you can get things like your own skull replica and T-shirts and all that sort of fun stuff in exchange for your donation to help us continue the research. So this is the first time we've done something like that. Hopefully people will get excited and want to be a part of it, because this really is the only testing like this that's being done at the moment. They've crossed the frontier of recovering the Neanderthal genome, and now, of course, they're using that in everything from HIV to cancer research. There are immediate and practical applications for this unusual DNA to helping humans, helping us now. And we're hoping to eventually get to that point with the Starchild, but there's nothing like the Starchild skull in the world at the moment. We get so excited about it. We just need a few more people to get excited so that we can get that final and accurate DNA answer.
Tell us a little bit more about the Neanderthal DNA and how's that helping us right now?
Well, this is something that is very easy to Google. Within the genome of the Neanderthal, there are all sorts of bits and pieces that have been changed over time by different illnesses, bacteria, other things that have made differences within the genome. People think that your DNA is absolutely set in stone, but it's not. There are a lot of factors that can change it. So they're looking at the way that genome has been changed over time by factors like cancer-causing organisms, and they're applying that to our genome, basically comparing its DNA to our DNA and finding out things that are maybe wrong in ours that are correct in its, or things that are a problem in both of them, that the Neanderthal DNA helps us to understand why that's a problem in ours and how it can be fixed. Now, we're not necessarily talking about gene therapy, but just in terms of the research, understanding how our DNA works, how these conditions like HIV, like cancer, affect our DNA, and using that in research that can then be used to develop potential treatments down the line. So it's certainly not an overnight solution, but it's absolutely fascinating to me that they're working on this. And we had a post on our Facebook, Facebook.com Starchild Project, a few days ago about the research that's being done, but it's very easy to Google it and see what they're doing. There is a host of work that's being done at the moment using the Neanderthal genome to directly help humans with medicine and with biotechnology today. And we certainly hope that that's the direction that the Starchild is going to go in.
Interesting. So it's kind of, you could have to recover things that we have lost along the way. It's weird, but it really... It really starts sounding like some of those stories I've heard about, certain other species coming down to this planet allegedly trying to seek help for their genetic, when that begins to fall apart pretty much. It's pretty bizarre, isn't it?
It is, but the more you think about these science fiction ideas and the more you look at what we're actually doing today, the more you realize, oh, if we had the sort of technology that these other beings, these extraterrestrials supposedly had, we would be doing exactly what they are. What's the first thing that humankind did as soon as we could travel in space? We went to the moon, claimed it for our own, and started talking about terraforming it, about building space farms and things on the moon. I mean, if we had the technology, we would absolutely be doing that. Why on earth would anybody think that any other species out there with the technology wouldn't act exactly the same way that we would and do? I mean, it makes complete sense. It's absolutely logical. But somehow when somebody puts that lab coat on and starts making fun of the idea, everybody throws logic out the window because they're just so afraid to be made to look foolish. I think it's just the silliest thing that we ignore everything that we know about the history of humankind whenever we're talking about aliens. We would absolutely do that. If there was a way for us to go to Mars or somewhere and bring back a solution to our health problems, we'd do it in a heartbeat. Of course any other species out there would be doing the same thing.
Now, we have the other one I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, that what you know. We talked, I think, with Lloyd a little bit about this as well, but the Denisova hominid.
Yes, the Denisovan hominid, yes. Now, this touches on what you were talking about earlier. They were just doing testing on a whole bunch of what they thought were Neanderthal bones, but in amongst those bones were two tiny little fingertips, absolutely small little, just two bones, that the DNA was different. Not a lot different, but just different enough to be absolutely, definitely a different species than Neanderthal. The bones look like Neanderthal. They're the same size, the same shape, the same weight, the same everything. But genetically, they are absolutely a different species. So it doesn't take having an entire colony, having hundreds and thousands of specimens for you to be able to say something's definitely a new species. Just those tiny fingertip bones were enough for them to create this new species, make it official, do everything. And of course now they've tested more bones and they've found more examples of it. But basically it's just sort of a new species of Neanderthal. It's a new species of pre-human. Very, very similar, apparently living together in some instances, but genetically different.
And there was, at this point here, there's speculation that basically there was, inbreeding between all these different species at that time as well, Neanderthals, Denisovo, and the idea there then is that part of that comes, out of that also comes eventually with something else probably in the picture, the modern, if we can call it that, a human being, right? Is that kind of the idea?
That's basically the idea. Now, Lloyd's theory was always that aliens intervened and that human beings, modern humans, Homo sapiens sapiens, are the result of genetic merging of Neanderthals and these alien beings, that they took the big, hairy, smelly Neanderthals and made them just enough like themselves that they would want to breed with us, that we could do the work for them without being offensive to them, just intelligent enough to do the work, not as intelligent as them. And, of course, all of this is covered in Lloyd's wonderful book, Everything You Know Is Wrong. But the idea of it happening that way is absolutely supported by the DNA research that's been done now, that says human beings only share about 4% of our DNA with Neanderthals, who are supposedly our closest relatives. Now, because it's only 4%, and we expected it to be a heck of a lot more than that, considering there's numbers out there like 98 and 99% the same as a chimpanzee, all of the evolutionists had to go and backtrack and say, oh, well, actually, no, Neanderthals must have had a much, much, much earlier common ancestor with humans, and they're a completely different branch of the family tree, so they aren't quite our closest living relatives anymore, but maybe they are and maybe they're not. And it's just turned into an absolute mess for them that they gloss over with a few fancy words and pretend that it hasn't happened. But for anybody that wants to go and read about it, it's absolutely out there. We share such a small percentage of our DNA with Neanderthal that the idea that there was some sort of intervention activity is much more scientifically plausible than the number of backflips and somersaults you have to do to try and make that fact fit in with the theory that is out there by the mainstream evolutionary scientists.
Now, obviously, we don't look like the Star Child do. We don't have that type of skull. So how do we explain that scenario of what happened there and what produced that, do you think?
Well, we think, based on the DNA that we have so far, that this is absolutely 100% a different species. Now, being a different species, that means that however it looks, whatever its features are, that is the way it's supposed to be. It's not some obscure deformity. There are things about this skull that just physically cannot happen to a human. There is no condition that causes the bone of our skulls to become thinner and lighter and harder. There's no condition that's going to make your brain grow a third larger than it ought to. There are just so many things about this that are radically different from a human, radically different from any kind of known deformity. And then on top of that, we have DNA that is so much different from a human DNA. If you or I were born with the same mitochondrial DNA as the Star Child skull, we absolutely could not survive it. There are parts of your DNA that have to be exactly the way they are, or you just can't survive it. One of those is the FOXP2 gene. Now, we've recovered a small section of the Star Child skull's FOXP2 gene. My FOXP2, your FOXP2, everybody in the world's FOXP2 gene is absolutely identical. There are a few very, very rare cases of people having one or two tiny differences in this gene, but it'll usually end up causing some sort of severe problem, like being completely unable to speak or having problems with your organs developing. It is crucial that FOXP2 gene is exactly the way it is in all humans. The small amount of that gene that we've recovered so far in the Star Child skull has 56 differences from a human's FOXP2 gene. That is just not possible. A human cannot survive that. A human can't survive it, but this being lived long enough not only to grow teeth, but to wear them down with use. That tells you right there very clearly this being is not human. And yet we're not quite to the point of being able to make that official and go through and do all the paperwork yet. We have to verify the results and recover a little bit more of the genome. But based on the preliminary work that we've done so far, this is absolutely an idiot-proof lockdown cinch. And yet somehow we still aren't getting the sort of assistance that we had hoped for to get the rest of the work done, but we're very, very close. We're working with a fantastic genetics team. We've already got that large amount of raw data. All we have to do now is just sequence it, and that could be it. We could be home free just from that one thing, just from decoding what we already have.
What would it take to get the entire DNA code, entire genome?
Well, to get the entire genome, that's a difficult question. It cost them about $6.4 million US to get the Neanderthal genome. Now, it's getting a little bit cheaper over time, but not a whole lot. So you can get a lot of it for not too much money, but to absolutely get the whole thing and to go through the amount of work that that you need to get everything. We're talking about millions of dollars, unfortunately, but just to decode what we have now, which could be a very significant chunk of the genome, is only $75,000. So, I mean, that's a very small and very affordable amount that we need to potentially get an absolute positive and definite answer.
And if you did have the whole DNA code, the entire genome, what would that tell you, do you think? I mean, that's really difficult to know, but what do you expect lies within that? What's the secrets there, if you will?
Well, the first thing that we hope to get is potentially proof that it's an extraterrestrial. We can prove it's a new species before we have the whole genome, but to make that extraordinary claim that this being is not native to planet Earth, we're going to need an incredible amount of evidence to support us there. So we really need the whole genome before that assertion can be made. But then on top of that, we've already discussed the potential medical and biotech advantages that could come one day out of this star child skull. We know the bone is much thinner and lighter than human bone, and yet it's much stronger and appears to have reinforcing fibers woven through the bone itself. If there was some way to apply that to us, even in just a localized way, if there was some shot you could get if you broke your arm that was going to make the bone heal more quickly, or if there was some treatment that could be developed for osteoporosis out of this, that would be amazing. We think it may have had the ability to grow multiple sets of teeth just based on the way the teeth in its mouth were worn, and the fact that it also had new teeth ready to come down like a shark. Wouldn't it be great if we could just do away with dentures entirely, if there was some way to translate that to a medical treatment to let humans grow a new set of teeth? The potential here is very, very broad, and unfortunately we can't start narrowing it down at all into what could actually happen and what probably isn't until we get that whole genome. I mean, we can't guarantee that anything will ever come out of it, but if for argument's sake, we gain nothing more than knowing that we have absolutely a new human-like species alive only 900 years ago. Now, that's 900 years ago. We're talking about Neanderthals that died out in the range of 22,000 years ago.
Right.
And we've got something that's only 900 years ago, living with humans, cohabiting with humans, interacting with humans. I mean, that is going to really turn anthropology and perhaps evolution absolutely on its head. This could open the doors to having actual proper discussions about so many of the wonderful topics that you have on your show that get swept under the carpet at the moment. Lloyd, I know, always hoped this would be the wedge that would open the door to having proper science done on all of these alternative things that so often get shunned. If we can just prove that they're wrong about one thing as big as the star child, I think that they really would have to eat some humble pie and start more seriously investigating some of those other alternative topics as well.
Well, what is the timeline on these events when the star child skull first lives and dies, I guess we can say, 1400s? No, wait, let me do some math on that.
Well, it depends which part of the world you're in. Now, this skull was found in the Copper Canyon region of Mexico. Now, at that time, it was still very much a hunter-gatherer lifestyle there. It was a semi-nomadic and nomadic population. They had cave dwellings. They would have had, in that area, during the good seasons, a quite happy and relaxed life. During the bad seasons, not quite so happy and relaxed. But elsewhere in the world, cultures were absolutely developing and coming along very thoroughly. We already had, all of the three R's and all of the civilizations going on in other places in the world. So this is a very recent thing. We're talking about absolutely, totally modern humans living with these beings. This is not cavemen existing with something that looked a little bit different and they perhaps didn't understand that it was a different species. These people would clearly have understood that there was something different and something special about this being and chosen to live alongside it anyway. It really does in some ways paint a much more tolerant and idyllic picture than we have in a lot of places in the world today.
So that would have been like around 1300, rather, to get an accurate number on that. And what do you think that was about? That was a revisit kind of thing. That was something that just a one-off. Do you think that it was a being that was dropped off or again born here under circumstances mingling of humans and something else, pretty much? What do you think?
Well, we don't have a definitive answer on that. There's a lot of theories about it. I can tell you that it is possible, we think, that this being spent some time in zero gravity, that it spent some time in space. If you look at the eye sockets of the Starchild skull, they're extremely shallow, and the holes and slits in the eye sockets, called the optic foramen, that's where your optic nerve and everything passes between your brain and your eye, those are shaped differently than they are in a human. So a very unusual eye socket. There is no deformity, there is no genetic condition, there is nothing on earth that makes your eye look anything like that, except for long-haul astronauts. Astronauts that spend more than 6 months in space, when they come back to Earth, they've all got vision problems. And that's because when you're in zero gravity for extended periods of time, your eye socket begins to shallow, and your optic foramen, those holes in your eye socket, start changing shape. Now, no one's been in space long enough to have their eye socket turn completely like the Starchild skull. But that is the closest comparison we can find of a being that has eye sockets like the Starchild skull, humans that have been in space for an extended period of time. So we think that therefore means it's possible that the reason this being had those eye sockets is because it did spend a lot of time in zero gravity. Now, again, pure speculation, but an interesting speculation.
Very interesting. Now, there's so many aspects to this and to the finds, of course, and to how it ties into our story alone here. Is there anything more in terms of the FOX P2 DNA report that could be mentioned in terms of what that tells us about what we're looking at here?
Well, your FOXP2 gene is what's called a supergene. It's crucial to the development of a number of systems in your body, everything from your brain to your lungs to your motor skills, and most famously, your ability to speak. Now, those people that we mentioned that have just one or two little things wrong with their FOXP2 gene, the most common characteristic and the way that they figured out that the FOXP2 gene even had anything to do with speech is there was an entire family that had the same change in their FOXP2 gene, and none of them were able to speak at all. They had perfectly normal mouths, perfectly normal vocal cords, but just couldn't speak. There was something in that gene that stopped them being able to speak in that way. So we've got a being with a very, very different FOXP2 gene that's related to speech. It has a very shallow roof of its mouth. Now, you have an arch in the roof of your mouth because you have to have room for your tongue to fit in there. This being did not have a whole lot of room for a tongue, so maybe it had a very different shape or a small tongue. There's no way for us to tell just based on the parts of the skull that we have left. It had no frontal sinus. That's sort of a hollow cavity up in your forehead that really isn't good for anything except making you miserable if you have hay fever or a cold, and giving your voice resonance. It's all to do with having the ability to speak and having the ability to make the sounds that we make as humans. This being didn't have any of those things. It's just different in every way, which of course has led to a lot of speculation about, was it perhaps telepathic? Did it communicate in a different way? These aren't questions we have the answers to at the moment, but it's certainly an interesting tie-in, another tie-in with the FOXP2 gene and the possible alien visitor theory.
Now, let's talk here a little bit more about the website. And again, I want you just to mention a little bit how people can basically get involved in this, and if they want to support the project and help you guys move forward. And if so, let's say you guys, and I asked Lloyd this many times as well, if you guys got the help that you needed, how quickly do you think we'd see results from this?
Well, if we had the funding today, the lab could start work on Monday. We're all set. We're all ready to go. They've even brought in new equipment specifically to work on the Starchild skull because they believe so much that the result is going to be just earth-shattering and they want to be associated with it. So we're absolutely ready to go. It's hard to give an exact timeline on DNA because it's not just you put it in the machine and press the button and it comes out and it's done. There's a lot of fiddling that is involved here. You have a dedicated computer system, specialized software, and then there is a programmer that just sits there every minute of the day that it's working to deal with all the little bits and pieces that are going to come up. Because this DNA is so different from human, the system isn't really equipped to handle it. There's human interaction the whole way along. So it would be months or even as much as a year before we would have that decoding answer. But in terms of DNA testing, I mean, that's spot on. That's exactly how long it would take anybody to do it. So we could have an answer by the end of next year, and that's certainly what we're hoping for.
Now, give us the website address again, and then also, I don't know if you have a personal one or something like that, Amy, that you'd like to give out as well?
Absolutely. It's just starchildproject.com, or if you're on Facebook, facebook.com/starchildproject. If you go to starchildproject.com, there's basically three things you can do to help us. One is to tell people about us. If you feel like you can't do anything but think we're worthwhile, which we certainly do, even if you just share us with one person or send one email to your local newspaper or TV station, just tell somebody about us. That's probably the easiest and most important thing you can do. You can make a contribution to us directly through PayPal, or you can make a contribution through what's called Indiegogo, and all the links are on the website, where you can actually get things like your skull replicas in exchange for your donation. So we're trying to make it as easy and as engaging as possible for people to come in and be a part of this, because we really think that it's important. And as I say, we do believe it's going to make history, and because of that, we have a little perk for people who donate $10. You can put your name up on our website and just prove that you knew this was going to be something special, sort of before it became cool, before it was all over your evening news. So please do visit starchildproject.com and do something to help us. This is too important, and it's too critical to everything that we understand about science, about medicine, about our place on this planet, for it to sit there for lack of just a few $1,000, which so many people would blow on a bad weekend in Vegas or what have you. It's not very much money to have a fantastic amount of research done, and we would certainly appreciate anyone's support in any way they can give it.
Well, I mean, I've talked many times with Lana about this, and you know, there's so many people, even actors are talking about this kind of stuff now. And then there's like, you know, if they have, you know, there could be some millionaires out there that just, you know, want to get in and get involved on this. And it's just, it's interesting to me that hasn't kind of occurred yet. I know that Lloyd wanted to make, you know, some, this into a film project as well at some point, and wanted to, you know, do a whole thing kind of around that. But it's amazing to me that more people haven't just kind of jumped in on it. But I think it is a good idea in the meantime to kind of disperse it out in until that person comes along, I guess. If that is even going to occur and happen, then you have this idea that, you know, the more people that get involved and donate just a little bit, that helps you guys along in the process, and at least it moves forward from there, you know. So that's a great idea. So starchildproject.com, that's the website. You have all the links right there. So do get involved if you're interested in being part of this. But we'll continue here in a little bit. So stay with us, Amy, and we'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
In the next hour, as we proceed, we are going to talk more about the forbidden subject of hominids and aliens. Later, we talk more about modern humans and the domestication of animals and the development of farming. Crops seem to have been genetically altered to work with the human digestive system, for example. And that is a very interesting but also uncomfortable piece of information. So we question what happened in our past and present a theory for you to consider. A very interesting continuation for anyone interested in Lloyd's work and how the research is going to continue from here on out. Also, don't forget that we have lifted all shows that we did with Lloyd Pye out of our archives on the members' website and made them available for free for everyone to stream or download. That's both hours of the 7 programs in total that we did with Lloyd. From redicecreations.com, you can just locate the In Memoriam section on the right-hand side and click on Lloyd Pye's name. You can also simply search for Lloyd Pye on our website and get the programs that way. Terry Mellonson, Randall Carlson, James Hall, David Talbot, and many, many more are coming up. But please join us right now on redicemembers.com. We'll continue with Amy Vickers. If you're not yet a member, sign up for a subscription and get full access to all our material. That means all our radio programs, our videos, films, music, commentaries, and the rest. I hope to see you there. Well, thank you for listening, and my thanks goes out to you, Lloyd Pye, as well, wherever you are.